Sherlock Holmes. The Old Court Radio Theatre Company presents The Lost Special by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatised for radio by M.J. Elliott.
James Bland, Superintendent, London and West Coast Railway Company, Liverpool. Special from Liverpool has not yet arrived. Foley, Manchester.
That telegram, Watson, was received at 6:15. After some discussion with the traffic manager, Mr. Bland sent a wire to St. Helens, which is a third of the way between the two cities. This was the reply.
Special passed here at 4:52, well up to time, doused to St. Helens.
10 minutes later, a second message was received from Manchester. Read it, if you please.
No sign of special as advised by you.
And then, 10 minutes later, another, even more bewildering.
Presume some mistake as to proposed running of special. Local train from St. Helens, time to follow it, has just arrived and has seen nothing of it. Kindly wire advices, Manchester. Holmes, do you mean to say the train simply vanished into thin air?
An even greater challenge than the disappearance of Mr. James Phillimore and his umbrella. In broad daylight, upon a June afternoon in the most thickly inhabited portion of England, a train and its occupants disappeared, as completely as if some master chemist had caused them to evaporate. An engine, a tender, two carriages, a van, five human beings, and all lost on a straight line of railway. Yes, Watson, I believe this incident to be absolutely unprecedented in the criminal annals of any country.
Five human beings, Holmes?
The driver, John Slater, the guard, James McPherson, the stoker, William Smith, a new hand, apparently.
And two passengers?
A Monsieur Louis Caratel and his strange companion.
And no doubt we're acting for the family of one or other of them?
No, Doctor. So far, no one has come forward to report them missing. No, our employers are the West Coast Railway Company. We are expected in Liverpool by Mr. James Bland, the gentleman who so kindly provided us with these telegrams.
And if we fail to arrive in Liverpool, Holmes, who will investigate our disappearance?
He came to my office on the 3rd of June, gentlemen.
This Monsieur Louis Caratel?
Well, that is the name he gave, Mr. Holmes. He was a small man, middle-aged and dark, with a marked stoop.
Suggesting some deformity of the spine.
Perhaps, Doctor, perhaps. And Caratal's companion, Mr. Bland?
Well, a man of imposing physique. His name was not mentioned, but he was certainly a foreigner. Or either a Spaniard or a South American, I would say. He was certainly a servant of some sort.
How can you be so sure of that?
Well, his deferential manner, his constant attention. There was one other thing. I'd completely forgot it until now.
No.
He carried a small black dispatch box in his left hand. It was fastened to his wrist by a strap. I didn't attach any importance to it at the time.
But subsequent events have endowed it with some significance.
Yeah, just so, Mr. Holmes. Well, Monsieur Caratel was shown up to my office while his companion remained outside.
I have arrived this afternoon from Central America, Mr. Bland, but I regret to say that affairs of the utmost importance demand I should be in Paris without the loss of an unnecessary hour.
Paris? Well, I'm afraid you've missed the London Express, monsieur. Perhaps a special could be provided, but, well, how do I put this?
Money is of no importance, and time is everything. If your company can speed us on our way, you may make your own terms.
I see. Well, I'll have a word with the traffic manager, Mr. Potter Hood. No doubt the matter can be arranged in 5 minutes.
5 minutes would be most satisfactory, Mr. Bland.
You misunderstand me, monsieur. The train itself will be ready to start in 3/4 hour. It will take that time to ensure that the line is clear.
Then an agreement was reached.
£50, 5 shillings, Doctor. A rate of 5 shillings a mile. The engine, number 247, on our register, was attached to two carriages with a guard's van behind.
Two carriages? But you only had two passengers, Mr. Bland. What purpose could the other carriage serve?
Solely to decrease the inconvenience arising from our oscillation.
Ah.
That was the first carriage. The second was divided into 4 compartments. A first class smoking, a second class and a second class smoking.
And which compartment was allotted to the travellers?
The first, Mr. Holmes, the one nearest to the engine.
And the other three were empty.
Just so. Monsieur Caratel and his companion demanded to be shown the carriage, even though I assured them that the better part of an hour must elapse before the line could be cleared.
They were both extremely impatient to be off. And there were no other incidents before the special pulled out.
Well, actually...
Yes, Mr. Bland.
I suppose you might call it a rather singular coincidence.
Holmes has a considerable interest in all things singular.
A request for a special isn't a very uncommon circumstance in a rich commercial centre, you understand. But the two should be required upon the same afternoon.
Who requested the second?
A Mr. Horace Moore, a gentleman of military appearance. In fact, I'd hardly dismissed Monsieur Caratel before he arrived.
It's absolutely imperative that I don't lose an instant in starting for London.
I quite understand, Mr. Moore. This must be quite distressing for you. I promise I'll do everything possible.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I'm afraid, however, that a second special is out of the question. The ordinary local service has been deranged by the first.
But my wife is not very...
There is an alternative. If you were willing to share the expense of Mr. Caratel's train... Perhaps you could travel in the other first-class compartment.
Why, yes, that would be perfect. Yes, I'll do it.
But your letter makes no mention of this Mr. Horace Moore. I deduce, then, that Monsieur Caratel objected to having him occupy the second compartment.
Well, it was difficult to see any objection to such an arrangement, and yet, when the suggestion was made to him, Monsieur Caratel absolutely refused to consider it for an instant. The train was his, he said, and he would insist upon the exclusive use of it.
Rather ungracious, it seems to me.
Finally, the plan had to be abandoned.
What became of Mr. Moore?
Oh, he left the station in great distress. I imagine he must have taken the ordinary slow train which leaves Liverpool at 6 o'clock.
And when did the special train containing Monsieur Caratel and his gigantic companion steam out of the station?
At 4:31 exactly. The line was at that time clear, and there should have been no stoppage before Manchester.
What's so special about Manchester?
Oh, the trains of the London and West Coast Railway run over the lines of another company as far as there, Doctor. The special should have reached there before 6 o'clock. But at 6:15, I was informed by Manchester that it had not yet arrived. I sent an inquiry to St. Helens, but, well, of course, you've seen the reply.
Your first thought must have been that there'd been some sort of accident. Perhaps the special had run off the metals.
No, the idea never occurred to me.
Really?
It seems hardly possible that the local train could have passed down the same line without observing such an incident, Watson.
Quite. And yet, what was the alternative? Where can the train be? I imagined it had possibly been sidetracked for some reason in order to allow the slower train to go past.
Is that normal?
If some small repair has to be effected, certainly. So I dispatched a telegram to each of the stations between St. Helens and Manchester. And here are the replies, in order of stations beginning at the St. Helens end.
Special passed here 5 o'clock, Collis Green.
Special passed here 5:06, Earlstown.
Special passed here 5:10, Newton.
Special passed here, 5:20, Kenyon Junction.
No special train has passed here. Barton Moss. These are deep waters in which we are adventuring, Mr. Bland.
This is unique in my 30 years of experience, Mr. Holmes. Absolutely unprecedented and inexplicable, sir.
We can say at least that whatever became of the special occurred between Kenyon Junction and Barton Moss.
And yet there is no siding, so far as my memory serves me, between the two stations. Well, Mr. Holmes, what do you recommend?
The driver of the local train has been questioned. Possibly he may have observed something which may throw some light upon the matter.
Both the driver and guard were positive there was nothing of any note between Kenyon Junction and Barton Moss.
If I were you, Mr. Bland, I'd dismiss both driver and guard at once. There's obviously been a wreck and they have missed it.
And how did the special run off the metals about stowing the line, Watson?
I can't say. But when one has eliminated the impossible, whatever remains must be the truth.
I doubt I could have phrased it better myself.
Then we're agreed. It must be so. No doubt we'll have a wire from Kenyon or Barton Moss presently to say that they've found her at the bottom of an embankment.
I'm afraid not, Dr. Watson. You see, I've ridden down the line myself. But all is clear. There are no traces of the missing special.
Mr. Blunt!
Ah, Hood, splendid. Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, this is our traffic manager, Mr. Potter Hood.
You have something to report, Mr. Hood?
Indeed I do, Mr. Holmes. They've just found the body of John Slater, driver of the special train.
These injuries to his head appear to be the cause of death.
Perhaps he fell from his engine, pitched down the embankment, and rolled among these gorse bushes.
Perhaps, Mr. Bland. Or perhaps the driver was pushed from his engine.
And still no trace of that missing train, gentlemen.
And I had begun to think life had become one flat and monotonous plane since the death of Professor Moriarty.
In any event, it's certain that poor Slater met his end by falling off his engine. Although why he fell, or what became of the engine after his fall, well, I no longer feel qualified to offer an opinion. How about you, Holmes?
I have no firm opinion as yet, Watson, but I am forming one by degrees. Mr. Bland, I imagine you have at your disposal a map of the area showing this stretch of railway?
Oh, certainly, Mr. Holmes, certainly, in my office.
Now, the country seems to have been dotted with ironworks and collieries.
Some are being worked and some have been abandoned.
And no fewer than 12 have small-gauge lines which run trolley cars down to the main line. These can, of course, be disregarded. Besides these, however, there are 7 which have, or had, proper lines running down and connecting with points to the main line.
To carry their produce from the mouth of the mine to the centres of distribution.
Quite correct, Doctor.
In every case, these lines are only a few miles in length. Out of the 7, 4 belong to collieries which are worked out, or at least to shafts which are no longer used. These are the Red Gauntlet, Hero, Slough of Despond, and Heartsease mines.
10 years ago, the Heartsease was one of the principal mines in Lancashire. But in each case, the rails nearest the main line have been taken up to prevent accidents. There's no longer any connection.
Thank you, Mr. Hood. Then these 4 sidelines may also be eliminated from our inquiry.
So there remain 3 other sidelines leading to the Carnstock Ironworks, the Big Ben Colliery and the Perseverance Colliery.
Of these, the Big Ben line isn't more than 1/4 mile long.
And it ends in a dead wall of core waiting removal from the mouth of the mine.
And the Carnstock Ironworks, Mr. Hood, might you know anything about that?
As a matter of fact, I do, Mr. Holmes. The line were blocked all day by 16 truckloads of hematite.
Nothing could have passed?
No, it's a single line, Doctor.
Which leaves the Perseverance line.
No, it's a large double line, which does a considerable traffic. The output of the mine is very large.
And on the 3rd of June, the day the special was lost, this traffic proceeded as usual?
Oh, yes. Hundreds of men, including a gang of railway plate layers, were working along the line.
A line of 2.25 miles in length.
Well, it's inconceivable that an unexpected train could have come down there without attracting universal attention.
And this branch line is nearer to St. Helens than the point at which the engine driver's body was discovered. So we have every reason to believe the train was past that point before misfortune overtook her.
It's rank lunacy, Holmes. Does a train vanish into thin air in England? In broad daylight, the thing's preposterous.
Mr. Holmes, can you give us any hope at all?
As the good doctor has already noted, it is one of the elementary principles of practical reasoning that when the impossible has been eliminated, the residuum, however improbable, must contain the truth.
And?
It is certain that the train left Kenyon Junction.
Of course.
And it is certain that it did not reach Barton Moss. It is in the highest degree unlikely, but still possible, that it may have taken one of the 7 available sidelines. It is obviously impossible for a train to run where there are no rails, and therefore we may reduce our improbables to the 3 open lines, despite the objections we have considered.
What are you suggesting, Mr. Holmes?
I wonder, Mr. Hood, is there a secret society of colliers, an English Camorra, which is capable of destroying both train and passengers?
Sounds somewhat improbable.
But it is not impossible. I confess that I'm unable to suggest any other solution. I should certainly advise the company, Mr. Bland, to direct all their energies towards the observation of those 3 lines, Carnstock, the Big Ben, the Perseverance, and of the workmen at the end of them.
But is that all?
No. A careful supervision of the pawnbroker's shops of the district might possibly bring some suggested facts to light. Please keep me advised as fresh developments, gentlemen. In the meantime, pressing business awaits me back in London.
Pressing business, Holmes.
Oh, the matter of the lost special is sure to sort itself out in due course, Watson. Hardly worthy of a place in your annals.
Pity. It seems so promising. The newspapers are offering a variety of suggestions to the mystery. One or two of them are feasible enough.
No.
A Dr. Thorndyke suggests that the train might have run off the metals and be lying submerged in the Lancashire and Staffordshire Canal. It runs parallel to the railway for some hundred of yards.
Indeed it does, Doctor. And I understand why this theory appeals to you, being so close to your own.
Well, it's worthy of consideration, isn't it?
Not to anyone who took the trouble to learn the depth of the canal before ever leaving London.
And I suppose it's insufficient to conceal so large an object?
Entirely insufficient. Is this the best that the readers of the Times can offer?
Well, an S. Blake, who describes himself as an amateur reasoner, calls attention to the bag, which appears to be the sole luggage the travellers brought with them. He believes some novel explosive of immense and pulverising power might have been concealed in it.
And the obvious absurdity of supposing that the whole train might be blown to dust while the rails remained uninjured reduces any such explanation to a farce. Really, Mr. Blake's amateur reasonings belong in the pages of a children's paper. Come.
Telegram for you, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you, Mrs. Hudson.
Perhaps Mr. Bland has followed your advice and the train has been located.
No. No, this is something else, Watson. It's from Mycroft.
Mycroft? What does he want?
He wishes to talk to me about Monsieur Louis Caratel, passenger on the Lost Special. I wonder why.
Perhaps the gentleman is a friend of Mr. Mycroft's, sir.
My brother is not a man with any intimate acquaintances.
Which means it must be something to do with his role in the British government.
So it would seem. Get your hat and coat, old fellow. We're going out. Mrs. Hudson, we shall have to turn dinner into supper, I'm afraid.
Oh, Mr. Holmes, I was just getting ready to serve it. Can't I tempt you with a nice piece of haddock?
My dear Mrs. Hudson, you have always been a temptation to me, but haddock, at the moment, is not.
A secret society of colliers. An English Camorra. Oh, really, Sherlock?
It's a peculiar thing, Watson. My brother and I have never been particularly close. And yet he seems to know my thoughts and words no matter where I might be.
I have eyes and ears everywhere, even in the north. I must say I'm profoundly disappointed in you, my dear boy. Your so-called solution has as much sense in it as the various conjectures put forward in the public press, which seriously assert that supernatural agencies have been at work.
And that Monsieur Caratel was actually Satan. I read that letter too, Mr. Holmes. The writer had a very curious name. Carnacki, was it?
When people are frightened, they turn to God. When they have no help from him, they look to the devil.
There are larger issues at stake here than you realise, Sherlock.
Then kindly enlighten me.
It is impossible for me to give you the full particulars.
Then we'll not disturb you any longer.
Suffice it to say that the country is in the throes of a political crisis. That crisis has its origins in France.
In France?
I know my brother concerns himself only with the agony columns, Doctor. But surely you must be aware of the famous trial in Paris, connected with a scandal in politics and finance. The public will never know just how monstrous that scandal is. But the honour and careers of many of the chief men in France are at stake.
And how does this affect England?
They are our allies, Dr. Watson. The impact of any blow that befalls them will eventually be felt here. At this very moment, a treaty is being... Well, I've already said too much.
This is all very fascinating, but apart from his nationality, what is the connection to Monsieur Caratal?
You've seen a group of ninepins standing, also rigid and prim and unbending. Then there comes the ball from far away, and pop, 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 there are your ninepins on the floor. Imagine some of the greatest men in France as these ninepins.
And Caratal was no doubt the ball. Coming from far away, bearing evidence kept in a locked dispatch box. If he arrives in France, pop, 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 for all of them.
You have it exactly, Sherlock.
Mr. Holmes, just who is Caratal?
He is well known as a financier and political agent in Central America. His companion is Eduardo Gomez, a violent man, whose reputation is that of a bravo and a bully.
Then this Gomez may be behind it all.
Unlikely, Doctor. We believe that he is honestly devoted to the interests of Monsieur Caratal, who, being a man of puny physique, employed Gomez as a guard and protector. Little good it did him, however. Powerful forces have determined that he should not arrive in Paris. Those forces have command of an unlimited amount of money. Absolutely unlimited. Do you understand, Sherlock?
I believe I do.
Now, I could settle the whole matter without ever leaving the Diogenes Club, but I feel I owe you the opportunity to redeem yourself. Mother always felt so terribly sorry for you.
If you wish to avoid any political upheaval, Mycroft, why are you assisting me? What if I should recover the evidence Caratal was conveying to France?
Oh, I'm quite satisfied that the evidence has been destroyed by now, and the crisis will pass. I'm simply indulging your curiosity. Now, if you'll both excuse me, it's nearly time for my nap. Think over what I've said, Sherlock. You'll soon be on the right lines.
I must say, Holmes, I thought your brother was being rather high-handed. I wonder you stood for it.
I stood for it, Watson, because Mycroft is correct. He knows what became of the Lost Special, and he sees the fatal flaw in my method.
Your method? Flawed? Impossible.
Ah, the key word. Impossible.
As in, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable...
must be the truth. In this instance, my old maxim has failed me. I failed to consider that my adversary might be possessed of limitless resources. So that which might seem impossible under ordinary circumstances now becomes possible.
So what now, Holmes?
The Delphic Oracle said, "Know thyself," but I must know my opponent. We return to Liverpool, Watson, and we begin again.
But Mr. Holmes, I thought we'd eliminated this line as a possibility.
So we had, Mr. Bland, so we had. But consider, an organisation with an unlimited sum of money and but a single aim, to stop Caratal reaching Paris at all costs. He had been delayed before arriving in Liverpool, and they knew he must therefore commission a special train. They bought off several officials, amongst whom the most important was James McPherson, whom they had ascertained to be the guard most likely to be employed upon a special. Smith, the stoker, was also in their employ.
Impossible.
I'm afraid not, Mr. Bland. Holmes has explained it all to me.
And Slater, the engine driver?
No, though he'd no doubt been approached, but found to be either obstinate or dangerous.
Or both.
Everything had been prepared days before. Only the finishing touches were needed. The sideline, which had been disconnected from the main line, was repaired. They would only have had to replace a few rails to connect it once more, and that could be done without danger of attracting attention. Now it was merely a case of completing a juncture with the line and arranging the points as they had been before. The sleepers had never been removed, and the rails, fish plates and rivets were all ready. When the special arrived, I imagine it ran off upon this small sideline so easily that the jolting of the points would have been entirely unnoticed by the two travellers.
But the line only leads to...
to the abandoned Heartsease mine.
Once one of the largest coal mines in England. For its entire length, this unused line runs through a deep cutting. No one could see the train unless they'd been standing on that edge.
As you can see, they'd removed the boards which covered the old mine and cleared the entrance. The rails run very close to the shaft for the convenience of loading the coal. They had only to add 2 or 3 lengths of rail in order to lead to the very brink of the shaft.
The very brink? Then the train is...
down there, Mr. Bland, along with its unfortunate passengers.
And if any doubt still exists, there is always this.
What is that?
This, Watson, is a funnel. All that remains of the Lost Special.
Mr. Holmes. Dr. Watson, come in. How very good of you to call upon me.
I felt certain of finding you at home, Monsieur de Lernac.
Well, as I'm presently under sentence of death, I could hardly be anywhere else. Tell me, have you been to Marseille before?
No, not for many years, and certainly not to the police cells.
Oh, it really is most irksome. All my great accomplishments in the field of crime over the years, and I find myself arrested for the murder of some merchant whose name I don't even recall.
Bonvalot.
Oh, thank you. But it really doesn't matter. Now that you're here, Mr. Holmes, I expect to receive a pardon before the week is out. Now tell me, Mr. Holmes, to what do I owe the honour of this visit?
The Lost Special.
But I understood that it was no longer lost.
Well, that is quite correct. But a few questions remain unanswered.
Such as?
Your employers.
You wish to make a record of my statement?
Naturally.
Splendid. Take out your notebook, then. At present, I shall mention no names. Or if you only heard the names, Mr. Holmes, what would you not think? I do not accuse them all of being conscious of what was to happen. There were, as you know, great financial as well as political interests at stake, and a syndicate was formed to manage the business. Some subscribed to the syndicate who hardly understood its objects. Oh, but others understood very well, and they can rely upon it that I have not forgotten their names.
They had ample warning that Caratal was coming long before he left South America, and knew the evidence he held would certainly mean ruin to all of them.
Precisely. So they looked round for an agent who was capable of wielding this gigantic power. The man chosen must be inventive, resolute, adaptable. A man in a million. They chose Charles de Lernac, and I admit they were right. With characteristic energy, I set about my commission within an hour of receiving my instructions, and the steps I took were the very best for the purpose which could possibly be devised. A man I could trust was dispatched instantly to South America to travel home with Caratal. Yet, had he arrived in time, the ship would never have reached Liverpool.
But it had already started before your agent could reach it.
I fitted out a small armed brig to intercept it. But again, I was unfortunate. Oh, you must not underrate the difficulties of my undertaking, or imagine that a mere commonplace assassination would meet the case. I was to destroy not only Monsieur Caratal, but Monsieur Caratal's documents and Monsieur Caratal's companions also, if we had reason to believe that he had communicated his secrets to them. And you must remember that they were on the alert and keenly suspicious of any such attempt. It was a task which was in every way worthy of me, for I am always most masterful where another would be appalled.
Thus you were quite prepared for Caratal's reception in Liverpool.
I was the more eager, because I had reason to believe he'd made arrangements by which he would have a considerable guard from the moment that he arrived in London.
Anything which was to be done must be done between the moment of his setting foot upon the Liverpool quay and that of his arrival in London.
I prepared 6 plans, each more elaborate than the last. Which plan would be used would depend upon his own movements. Do what he would, I would be ready for him. If he had stayed in Liverpool, I would be ready. If he took an ordinary train, an express or a special, I would be ready. everything had been foreseen and provided for.
Surely you could not do all this yourself, Monsieur de Lernac. What do you know of the English railway lines?
Oh, money can procure willing agents all the world over. And I soon had one of the acutest brains in England to assist me, a man with a considerable future before him, unless some complaint of the throat carries him off before his time.
The younger brother of the late Professor Moriarty is, or was, a station master, I recall.
I will mention no names, but it would be unjust to claim all the credit for myself. My English ally was worthy of such an alliance. He knew the London and West Coast line thoroughly, and he had the command of a band of workers who were trustworthy and intelligent. The idea was his, and my own judgment was only required in the details.
He it was, perhaps, who bought the services of Macpherson and Smith.
Yes, at a price which would make them independent for a lifetime. I do not go so far as to say that the English are more honest than any other nation, but I have found them more expensive to buy.
But you could not buy John Slater, the engine driver.
No, not he. We had no certainty that Monsieur Caratel would take a special, but we thought it very probable, for it was of the utmost importance to him that he should reach Paris without delay. It was necessary he and Gomez should be involved in a common fate, so our plans to that end were much facilitated by their request.
And once that special was ordered, your plan went into effect. Beginning with the appearance of Mr. Moore, the gentleman who desired to travel to London on the same train in order to be at his wife's sickbed.
I've always had a flair for accents. I was most satisfied with my performance as Horace Moore. It was my intention to board the train, shoot Caratel and his bodyguard, and then destroy the papers Gomez kept in his dispatch box.
And yet Caratel refused to admit any other traveller.
He was on his guard, alas. But it was my duty to make certain that Monsieur Caratel never arrived in Paris. Like all great organisers, I was prepared for failure and had an alternative course of action prepared.
Your assistant, Mr. Moriarty.
I have mentioned no names.
He controlled the points in order that he might superintend the switching off of the train.
He had four armed men with him, so that if the train ran off the line, we thought it probable because the points were very rusty, we might still have resources to fall back upon. Having once seen it safely on the sideline, he handed over the responsibility to me. I was waiting at a point which overlooks the mouth of the mine, and I was also armed, as were my two companions. Come what may, you see, I was always ready. It may be that the slowing down of the train first attracted the attention of the travellers, but it was running at full speed again before their heads appeared at the open window. It makes me smile to think how bewildered they must have been. Well, picture to yourself your own feelings, Mr. Holmes, if, on looking out of your luxurious carriage, you suddenly perceived that the lines upon which you ran were rusted and corroded, red and yellow with disuse and decay. The train was running with frantic speed, rolling and rocking over the rotten line, while the wheels made a frightful screaming sound. I was close to them and could see their faces. Caratel was praying, I think. There was something like a rosary dangling out of his hand. And Gomez roared like a bull who smells the blood of the slaughterhouse. He saw us standing on the bank, and he tore at his wrist and threw the dispatch box out of the window in our direction.
He was offering the evidence in return for their lives. You did not oblige.
Well, business is business, Mr. Holmes. Besides, the train was now as much beyond our control as theirs. Gomez ceased howling when the train rattled round the curve and they saw the black mouth of the mine yawning before them. The sight seemed to have paralysed him. I had wondered how the train, running at a great speed, would take the pit into which I had guided it, and I was much interested in watching it. One of my colleagues thought it would actually jump it. And indeed it was not very far from doing so. Fortunately, however, it fell short and the buffers of the engine struck the other lip of the shaft with a tremendous crash and the funnel flew off into the air.
I found it.
Did you? Oh. Yeah, the tender and carriages and van were all smashed up into one jumble, which, with the remains of the engine, choked for a minute or so the mouth of the pit. Then something gave way in the middle, and the whole mass of green iron, smoking coals, brass fittings, wheels, woodwork and cushions all crumbled together and crashed down into the mine. We heard the rattle as the debris struck against the walls, and then there came a deep roar as the remains of the train struck the bottom. The boiler must have burst, for a sharp crash came after the roar, and then a dense cloud of steam and smoke swirled up out of the black depths, falling in a spray as thick as rain all around us. Then the vapour shredded off into thin wisps, which floated away in the summer sunshine, and all was quiet again in the Heartsease mine.
And then, having carried out your plans so successfully, it only remained to leave no trace behind you.
Except for the funnel.
Except for the funnel.
Our little band of workers had already ripped up the rails and disconnected the sideline, replacing everything as it had been before, and we were equally busy at the mine. The fragments were thrown in, the shaft was planked over as it used to be, and the lines which led to it were torn up and taken away. Then, without flurry, but without delay, we all made our way out of the country.
Your plan miscarried, Monsieur de Lernac.
Oh?
There was one flaw in all your admirable calculations. John Slater, the driver.
It was the plan that Macpherson should chloroform Slater so that he should vanish with the others. But he did his business so clumsily that Slater, in his struggles, fell off the engine and broke his neck in the fall. A man who has had so many triumphs as I can afford to be frank, and I must agree with you. John Slater is the single flaw in one of those complete masterpieces which are only to be contemplated in silent admiration.
Was Macpherson punished for his actions?
Well, I understand it was his intention to emigrate to America and then, after a suitable period, to send for his wife. Perhaps it would be a kindness, Mr. Holmes, if you were to visit her and assure her that there is no impediment to her marrying again.
I understand. Of course, you secured the bag of papers Gomez threw out the window and brought them to your employers.
Oh, most of them. I took one or two little papers as a souvenir of the occasion. Oh, be sure you write that down, Mr. Holmes. I have no wish to publish these papers, but still, it is every man for himself in this world, and what else can I do if my friends will not come to my aid when I want them?
That is the purpose of your statement, then. Blackmail?
It is not out of mere pride or boasting that I give this information. If that were my object, I could tell a dozen actions of mine which are quite as splendid. I do it in order that certain gentlemen in Paris may understand that I, who am able to tell about the fate of Monsieur Caratel, can also tell in whose interest and at whose request the deed was done.
Unless the reprieve you are awaiting comes very quickly.
With these men in Paris, they know Charles de Lernac, and they are aware that his deeds are as ready as his words. I have been true to my employers, and I have no doubt they will be true to me now.
How are they to know, monsieur?
How? Well, when your statement is published, of course.
But you have given me no statement. Good day, Monsieur de Lernac. We are ready to leave now.
Holmes? Holmes? Holmes?
You You have been listening to The Lost Special by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, dramatised for radio by M.J. Elliott. You heard Jim Crozier as Sherlock Holmes and Dave Hawkes as Dr. Watson, with Jesse Powis as James Bland and Vince Webb as Charles de Lernac and Potter Hood. Mrs. Hudson was played by Lindsay Lloyd, Mycroft Holmes by Brian Adrian, and Louis Caratal by James Crook. The play was directed by Roger Johnson and produced by Dennis Rookard for Hozzyprog Productions.